Chapter 7. We should be in tonight, then for Zoe. The hours here are so long and boring, at times I feel I want to talk with someone. The first steamer we sighted raised high hopes, at least her smoke did, for we saw enough smoke on the horizon to make us think we were to see the Grand Fleet, and we dived. We cruised towards her for about half an hour, and then hung about where we were, as we found that her course would take the ship close to us. As the situation developed, Dalton, who was up in the conning tower at the A periscope, gave us a certain amount of information, and we gathered that all this smoke was pouring out of the pipe stem tunnel of a wretched little English tramp. I found it irritating, standing at my action station, and not knowing what was going on. There is only one good job in a submarine, and that is the captain's. He knows and decides everything. The rest of us are in his hands. I object on principle to my life being held in Alton's hands. It is all very well for the crew, they have no imagination, and their mental horizon stops at the walls of the boat. They have the consolation of mechanical activities. They make and break switches, and open and close valves. They work with their hands. As we attacked the steamer, all one heard was murmurs from Alton, such as, raise, lower, take her down to 10 meters, half speed, slow, bring her up to 5 meters, raise, lower. At length I heard the welcome order, starboard tube, stand by, which was followed almost immediately by the order, fire. There was a kind of coughing grunt, and the starboard torpedo proceeded on its errand of destruction. Every ear was strained for the sound of the explosion, but all we got was a torrent of blasphemy from Alton. The torpedo had jumped clean out of the water 100 yards short of the steamer, and had dived under the ship. So I gathered later, when Alton had calmed down somewhat. We were about to surface and give her the gun, when Alton took a sweep round with the skyscraper, and discovered one of those wretched little airships about a mile away, coming towards the steamer. We decided to bottom and have lunch. Over lunch we discussed the misadventure. Alton was loud in his curses of Tanzer Man, the torpedo lieutenant at Bruges, from whom he had got the torpedo in guaranteed good condition only 48 hours before we sailed. He launched forth into a tirade against the torpedo staff at Bruges, and warming to his subject, he abused the whole of the depot personnel, whom he stigmatized as a set of hard-drinking, shore-loafing ruffians, who were incapable of realizing that they existed for the benefit of the boat's personnel and material. I disagreed. There is a tendency on the part of these submarine officers, who have been U-boating a long time, to get into narrow grooves. Most reserve officers are not like this, as they have only been in during the war. Alton is an exception. He left the Hamburg America on 2 years' half pay in 1912, and was kept on in 1914. After all, the depot staff are Germans, and as such labor for the fatherland, and though their work in office and workship is not so dangerous as ours, on the other hand they have not got the stimulation before their eyes, of glory to be gained. I am of the opinion that the torpedo broke surface because, being fired from the outside tubes, it probably started too shallow, dived deep, recovered shallow and dived deep, broke surface and dived very deep. A sticky motor or sluggish weight would give this effect. And are these external tubes watertight? Theoretically yes, but what of practice? We have been down to 40 meters several times during this trip, and not once have we had a chance on the surface of getting at the two external tubes, add to which our depth gear, with the pivots of the weight exposed to water, if the tube does flood, and then you have rust, corrosion and heaven knows what complications. I saw a British Mark 1150 torpedo at the torpedo shop at Bruges the other day, and I was much struck with their deep depth gear, which is of the unrestrained Alan type, weight and valve interdependent. The main feature is that the whole gear is contained in a separate, watertight chamber. Our system is certainly a great saving in space, and is much neater in design. While I prefer the ELAN principle of valve conjuncting with weight, but it would be interesting to know whether the British have much trouble with the depth keeping of their torpedo. After lunch we had a good look round, but the small airship was still hanging about, flying in large circles. We were surprised to meet one of these despicable little sausages or zeppelin spawn, as the navigator calls them, so far from land, and at dark we surfaced and proceeded on one engine on an easterly course, charging the battery right up with the other engine. Dawn revealed a blank horizon, not a vestige of mast, funnel or smoke in sight. We ambled along in fine cold weather, and I took advantage of the peacefulness of everything to do a good series of Mueller on the upper deck, stripped to the waist. Alton silently watched me from the conning tower, with a sneering expression on his face. The navigator, who is quite a decent youngster, though of no family was, I could plainly see, struck by my development, and asked to be initiated into the series of exercises. I agreed to show them to him. At about 11 a.m., a couple of masts, then two more, then another, appeared above the horizon. The visibility was extreme, so we dived and proceeded at full speed, 10 meters. We had been going for half an hour, when Alton had another look at the convoy. We eased speed, came up to 6 meters, and Alton proceeded up into the conning tower to use a periscope. He had hardly applied his eye to the lens, when he sharply ordered the boat to 10 meters, accompanying this order with another to the motor room demanding utmost speed. "Look!" he exclaimed pointing to the periscope, forgetful of the fact that we were at 10 meters. I looked, and of course saw nothing. Furious at the trick I considered he had played on me, I turned on him, to be disarmed by his apology. "Sorry. I forgot. The whole British battlecruiser force is there." It was now my turn to be excited, and I rushed down to the motor room determined to give her every amp she would take. The port foremost motor was sparking like the devil, rings of cursed sparks shooting round the commutator, but this was no time for ceremony. I ordered the field current to be reduced. We were actually running with an FC of 3.75 amps, for a period, when the sparking assumed the appearance of a ring of fire, and, fearing a commutator strip would melt, I ordered an FC of 5 amps. The lower the field current, the faster the motor goes. 3.75 is almost incredibly low for a motor of this type, at least according to British practice. We passed a quarter of an hour full of strain. Alton had announced his intention of using the stern torpedo tube, after his failure in the morning, and the crew of this tube were crouched at their stations like a gun's crew in the last few seconds before opening fire. The switchboard attendants gripped the regulating rheostats, as if they could urge the boat on faster. Old Schmidt never lifted his eyes from the compass repeater. "Slow both. Bring her to 6 meters. The periscope was raised. A groan came from Alton and he turned away. Yes. It was all over. There they were, and with hungry eyes and depressed heart I saw 5 great battlecruisers, of which I recognized the Tiger with her 3 great funnels, the Princess Royal, Lion and 2 others, zigzagging along at 25 knots, at a distance of 12,000 meters, across our bow. They were surrounded by a screen of destroyers and light cruisers, the former appearing as black smudges. I could not tear myself away from the sight of those great brutes, whom I had fought in the Derflinger at Dogger Bank, and again when in the Koenig at Jutland. So near and yet so far, and as they drew away, so did all the visions of an iron cross. As soon as they were out of sight, we surfaced in order to report what we had seen to Zeebrugge and Heligoland. Everything seemed against us. I had gone on the bridge with the navigator. Alton, with a face as black as hell, had gone to the wardroom. I heard a fearful altercation going on below. I stepped down to find the young wireless operator trembling in front of Alton, who was overwhelming him with a flood of abuse. As I reached the wardroom, Alton shook his fist in the man's face and bellowed. "Make the damn thing work, I tell you. Impossible Captain, the main condenser, purple with rage, Alton seized a heavy pair of parallel rulers and hurled them in the operator's face. Bleeding copiously, the youth fell to the deck stunned. I noticed a half-empty bottle of spirits on the table, which colossal quantity he must have consumed in about a quarter of an hour. Turning to me, this madman pointed to the wireless operator with his foot and growled of him removed. This I did, then lowering the periscope, I ordered the boat to 15 meters. We proceeded at this depth until 8 p.m., when I was informed that the captain was in his bunk and wished to see me. I discovered him with his face to the ship's side, and upon my reporting myself he ordered me, first to throw that blasted bottle overboard, it was empty, and secondly to surface, and shape course for Zeebrugge. At midnight he relieved me. The wireless operator has been laid up all day, and has a nasty cut on the head. The navigator, a great scandal monger, has heard from the engineer that Alton was speaking to him alone this morning, and the engineer believes that Alton has given him 500 marks to say he fell down a hatch. Blankenberg buoy has just been reported in sight. Diary of a U-boat commander.